So we are fortunate to have a very strong relationship with the Community Health Worker Network of New York, who work closely with the Prevention Research Center to provide 105-hour training on core competencies. And so they're a great resource. And then we supplemented that training with additional trainings. So, for instance, our community health workers were taking blood glucose and cholesterol, and so they did get a phlebotomy training and other cultural competency trainings that were out there. So we use that as the Community Health Worker Network training curriculum as a core, and we would supplement it with other trainings as needed.
Thank you. Okay, now we're going to move across the United States to and across the waters to Hawaii. I am very excited to present to you Vanessa Buchtal. She is a doctoral candidate in public health at the...
I'm a doctor.
Oh,
she
has a DRPH. Okay. She earned her MSPH at the UCLA School of Public Health. For the last 4 years, she has worked as an evaluator with the Healthy Hawaii Initiative Evaluation Team at the University of Hawaii Manoa Office of Public Health Studies. And today she's going to present to us a very novel intervention, Growing Health, Cultural Assets for Garden-Based Diabetes Prevention with an Urban Filipino and Pacific Islander Community. Welcome.
Okay, thank you. And I am going to be different from everybody else because what this basically was formative research in the Kalihi community of Honolulu, Hawaii. Now, Kalihi is roughly 41% Filipino and about 35% Pacific Islander. About 20% of that is Native Hawaiian and the rest are Samoan, Micronesian. It's a very, very diverse community. And what this study was to do basically is to establish a baseline for understanding what's going on within the community in terms of gardening skills, appropriate garden curricula for the area. Okay, I have no disclosures. This study basically was done, I work with the SNAP Ed program and the Department of Health, and I partner with a number of community agencies. And this study was done really to support our local community agencies in developing their own garden-based, place-based curricula. Okay, so why gardening? Well, in Hawaii at least, I mean, there's profound disparities in diabetes and cardiovascular disease among both our Filipino and Pacific Islander populations. There's also low fruit and vegetable consumption and high rates of food insecurity in these populations, and particularly in the community, in the neighborhood, the urban neighborhood where I worked, has the highest rate of food insecurity in the state. Within these populations, these are the populations where food insecurity is concentrated. It's also one of the lowest income neighborhoods in the state, and it is a neighborhood where issues of access as well as issues of education are profound. So what we're seeing in this community is a growing use of garden programs. People are getting very excited by them. They're leaping up. There's a wonderful garden program up at the end of the valley, but there's also a lot of other community agencies that are looking at, when we're doing diabetes prevention, when we're doing obesity prevention, let's bring in gardening. But most of what's available is garden curricula from the mainland. And garden curricula that really is not designed for this population. So our first question we had is, are the garden programs that folks are picking up and using culturally appropriate for urban Filipino and Pacific Islander communities? And in particular, in Hawaii, the Filipino community was originally an agricultural community. Many of the folks who came to Hawaii came to work in our agricultural industry. They came from rural areas. Usually they're more Visayan, more Visayan, more Ilocano, less Tagalog-speaking, less urban Filipinos. And so you're questioning, that's the aunties and uncles, the grandparents within this community. We do have data showing that among younger Filipinos, and among the Filipino population overall, fruit and vegetable consumption is a real issue. They're some of the lowest consuming groups. They have some of the lowest rates. But there's a difference in age between older and younger. So we wanted to see how that played out in home gardening. And also, are there assets within these communities for garden promotion? Instead maybe of looking to the mainland, should you be looking within your community and finding the people that have the resources, who know how to do what needs to be done within this community to appeal to this population? And what cultivation practices are appropriate for these low-income urban environments? Okay, so the objectives of our study were to identify the existing community assets for home gardening and to learn from those who are already doing it what works for the community. So we wanted, this was essentially an environmental scan. We wanted to see how many people are already gardening in this community, what specific foods do people choose to grow, and what skills have people developed for working in this growing environment. And you'll see that all of the photographs that you see were photographs that were taken during our scan. So this is actually an example of one of the ways that people do work within the community and within their limitations, growing in small spots of land, growing on fences, growing, stealing little pieces of land, appropriating unused land to grow. So here's our methodology. We did a random sample of 20% of all census tracts in this community. We basically, you know, we drew the census map, and then we used a random number generator to pull census, that should have said census blocks, to pull census blocks. And then we went out and did a windshield survey, which means that we went at a walking pace entirely around each census block, looking at the prevalence of home fruit and vegetable growing, the types of fruits and vegetables that were grown, and also noting down the cultivation methods. How were people using land? How were people using the resources that they had? So this is our sample. This was the 20% random sample. And the thing I do want you all to know, Kalihi is an ahahuaa, which means it's a traditional Hawaiian measure of land. The Hawaiian communities tended to go from mountain to ocean, so that you could include a wide variety of resources. And Kalihi is, in fact, an ahahuaa. Up here in this area is up in the valley, edging up against the mountains, and this is it's a higher income area, it's more single family homes. People have a little bit more space up here. When you come across here, this was mixed development, mixed business, multifamily housing. This is where most of the housing projects, the low income housing and subsidized housing in Honolulu actually is all the housing projects right in here. And then when you come down this way, this area is all zoned industrial. But it was once a Filipino community, a Filipino residential community, about 80 years ago. So you do have little houses scattered out in here, sitting next to machine shops, sitting next to other industrial uses, and sitting in among very low-income brick apartment buildings. So you have some very different environments within this 5-square-mile urban neighborhood. Okay, once we had developed our sample, the next thing we needed to do was to train our observers to make sure we had some reliability. That's actually one of our graduate students. This project was done by myself and 5 graduate students, and what we did, we started with classroom training to make sure that our observers knew what they were looking at. So we did a classroom training on Filipino and Pacific Islander fruits and vegetables, looking at what the trees, what they looked like in various stages of fruit and flower. We then took hands-on training up to the botanical gardens so that they could see it in place. And then we followed that up with field training within the community, where we actually went out and did trial runs as groups to make sure that people knew what they were looking at. Our observers then went out in pairs, and they were instructed to work together, discuss and come to agreement on their observations, and if there was anything they were still uncertain about, each team had a camera, and they were instructed to photograph anything they did not recognize. And within the teams, what we did was, instead of having two people always go out together and these two people always go out together, we made sure that we rotated so that we could ensure consistency across our groups. Then once everybody was trained, what we did was we sent them all out to travel all the publicly accessible areas in each census block. Each team was given a packet, and they traveled the block at walking speed, assessing all visible growing spaces, front yard, side, backyards, sidewalk medians. They were instructed to look for things that were growing in public parks, things that were growing along alleyways, look for container gardens, and also to look for any trees that were visible over fences or around roof lines. And one of the issues, actually, that was kind of interesting that we had a white middle-class fellow professor question how we could possibly know what was going on in this community if we weren't looking in backyards. Well, we were, for starters, we were seeing backyards. But when you look in these urban low-income neighborhoods, part of what you see is that people are using every inch of land they can, and also that you do not have the blocked-off fences. You can see backyards in low-income neighborhoods because people are using chain-link fencing. And they're growing where they can. They're not preserving. It's not landscaped in front and my little garden in the back. It's I've got some land. It's got the right amount of sun. I'm planting something in it. So this was our data collection packet. Basically, the observers did a quick hash mark, just noting the number of properties that were growing something, and then they observed what we had a list of what kinds of foods and that we had developed from the most likely that they could just quickly hash down. We also had them identifying if there were community gardens or communal spaces, and then this was all brought back and to this data was added the zoning for the specific census block, whether it was single-family, multifamily, business, or industrial mixed use, the number of properties, tracts or parcel per census block. This actually was kind of a headache. We wound up going with Google Maps because they actually did very clearly, you know, if you visualized the census block, the particular block, you could see the property lines. And then the population per block to get a sense of population density. Then we analyzed the data to look at the prevalence of home food cultivation, the types of food cultivated, and we looked at really differences in fruit and vegetable consumption, difference in cultivation patterns by zoning, and looking, because one of our questions had been whether or not poverty was an issue in terms of what people grow or how much they were able to grow. We looked at the number of gardens observed and poverty level, and we looked at differences in land use and in garden structures by zoning. Okay, this classic use. This is in the Upper Kalihi area where you have very small yards. Like I said, no problem seeing what people are growing. It's all kind of out in the front yard there to see. What we found was surprising. We found that 93% of the blocks that we studied had at least one home garden. There were 366 home gardens identified. That was fully a quarter of all properties in the community. So it's not in this urban, low-income neighborhood. It is not the case that people are not gardening. There's quite a few who are. But what we did see was a significantly higher prevalence of fruit as opposed to vegetable cultivation. I mean, it was overwhelming. And at one point we decided that we really ought to rename this whole study the If You Can Stick a Papaya in It, Somebody Has. and I think that there's reasons for that. because if you plant a fruit tree, particularly papaya, banana, they grow very easily. You stick it in and you've got fruit for several years with relatively little maintenance, whereas vegetable gardens are actually much more labor intensive. There may also be a cultural preference for many of these fruits, and I think that people, particularly in low-income neighborhoods, they prioritize the things they want that are expensive in the store. Which would be the fruits primarily. We did find that vegetable gardens were much more common in single-family zoning than in all other zoning types, but we were surprised at how much gardening we saw even in the industrial neighborhoods. But in the industrial neighborhood, it was more likely to be three papaya trees stuck in a lot, or the banana stuck up. I think my personal favorite was this patch of bananas that was growing in front of a machine shop. There were no differences, really, that we could see statistically by poverty level of the block, although there were differences by zoning. The most common foods that we saw were papaya, citrus, mango, and banana. Papayas were 38% of all plants we saw, actually. I said it was the papaya study. What we did see was that food growing was not confined to backyards in this community. That people often used common space around parks, apartments, alleyways. There was one alleyway I remember driving down where someone had taken the entire space along the sides to grow eggplant. And as you drove down this narrow alleyway, the little eggplants would just bounce off your windows on both sides. It was very common for people to grow basil or eggplant as hedges outside their property lines. It was also common to see sweet potato used as a ground cover in the front yard, and for squash vines to be used as trellises, shades, and fence covers. Gardens were very frequently located inside and front yards, I think because often that was where you had the best light. And in our neighborhoods, and this, I don't know how this is going to carry out to other places, but in these older neighborhoods, often what people had in the backyard was a mango tree. And that, while it produces lovely mangoes, it shades out the possibility of growing vegetables. What we also saw was that fruit trees persisted. So if someone planted a fruit tree, that was fruit for the generations. Instead of being a container garden that had to be replanted, once they got that fruit tree going, some of those trees might have been 30, 40 years old. And we did see, of course, that green onions were the most common container plant. That, again, something that costs a lot of money in the store that's very easy to grow at home. There were limitations to this study. Some food may have been missed due to observer error. Fruits that were not in season definitely would be less likely to be identified, and that may be that some of the predominance of fruit may be that fruit trees are more easily seen than vegetable plantings. And also that fruit trees persist, and it may be that the person whose yard that fruit tree is in did not plant it, although they are certainly currently benefiting from it. But our conclusion basically was that the food growing environments and the preferences and norms differed from the home gardening curricula that we had seen, and that we did identify that this community had substantial assets for fruit and vegetable growing, that there was expertise within the community that really should be tapped, that if someone wanted to develop a garden-based curricula to reduce obesity and diabetes within the community, maybe the best step would not be to reach to the mainland for a curriculum, but go to the community and find the aunties and uncles. Work with folks. And in essence, what's gone from here is that we took this study and we gave it to the community agencies that we work with, and they are using this data actually to support their own grant writing, to develop their own curricula and to develop their own programs that are more community-based. And that's it.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. Really fascinating work. Before I turn it up to the audience for questions, I just want to make a few announcements. on behalf of APIC. So we have an exciting session coming up right after this on immigration reform and the Affordable Care Act. That's at the 10:30 session. That's at the convention center in 258C. So here are the flyers. We also have our APIC social tomorrow night. And we have the honorary Lisa Wong and Ninez Ponce, who is professor at UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, and also the PI of the California Health Interview Survey. So we have flyers, posters for that, and we encourage you to attend both events.